Collins, if you would come and join us, because the first thing we have to do is move the committee report, and we can't do that without a quorum.
Or we can listen to the bell.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, it seemed to me it would be appropriate to at least hear what the bill is.
Okay, Senator Lori, why don't you go ahead and start explaining your bill, and then as soon as we have a quorum, we'll make the proper motions. Now, Senator Higgins is here, and we're just one short.
Okay.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is Senate File 2974 regarding health electronic records, establishing a health information exchange oversight. I think many members may be aware Congress last year approved the High Tech Act, which was really in two parts. The first part was for state grants to build the infrastructure that this is actually working toward, and the Department of Health did apply for and was granted a $9.6 million award to be working on this. The second part is $29 billion worth of federal funds to support the provider community in establishing meaningful use of electronic health records. And Minnesota's healthcare providers and hospitals are anticipated to receive somewhere between $450 and $800 million in this incentive funding for their demonstration of meaningful use. And to the extent that we do a good job of building this infrastructure to allow meaningful transaction and meaningful use of electronic health records, our provider community will be more competitive in these grants and get closer to that $800 million goal. That's the goal of all of us here. So with that initial funding, between October 2009 and January 2010, the Minnesota eHealth Advisory Committee, in conjunction with the Minnesota Department of Health, convened public work groups around the state to develop recommendations on health information exchange and sound practices in five critical domains identified by the Office of the National Coordinator. Those are governance, finance, legal policy, technical infrastructure, and business and technical operations. What this bill does is it sets up a legal framework for that health information exchange. The eHealth Advisory Committee recommended a mechanism to oversee health information exchange activities, and those recommendations in this bill are intended to ensure that the information follows the patient across the full continuum of care, that it prevents the fragmentation of health information that can occur when there is a lack of interoperability or cooperation between health information exchange service providers. It ensures that organizations engaged in health information exchange are adhering to nationally recognized standards. It ensures that health information exchange service providers properly protect patient privacy and security. And it ensures that Minnesota has a reliable health information exchange infrastructure in place by late 2010 to allow Minnesota providers and hospitals to achieve those meaningful use incentives. That's, again, to get us closer to the $800 million estimate for our provider community. A few amendments were adopted to this bill over the course of going through the committees to ensure a level playing field. These were really important and welcomed amendments. And then also, this is the Finance Committee, of course. The fiscal note came out, and it did show a savings, but there was an amendment that will be in the committee report that actually lowers the fees, because there's no general fund money. It's a fee-supported endeavor undertaken by the Minnesota Department of Health, and one of the amendments that will be adopted lowers those fees to actually equal the cost of implementing this program. So it looks like you have a quorum probably. You can go ahead and do
Mr.
your...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Senator Lori, would you like the amendment?
I think we need to adopt the committee report first.
I'd move the committee
report. Yeah, well, let's do that. First, Senator Stump moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Stump.
And then I move the amendment that...
There's two amendments. So you have the A8 or the A9?
Okay, the A9 amendment. Do we have that?
A9.
Has that been distributed?
The A9 amendment was drafted by counsel and is some very technical cleanup I believe that there was a oral amendment to the amendment on line 117 of the A9 amendment. We were going to strike the word state government.
Thanks. Okay, so that'll be incorporated into the amendment.
And with that, we would support the A9 amendment. It would be helpful.
Okay, let's wait till it's distributed.
What are we doing? What did I miss? Anything?
Okay, Senator Stumpf moves adoption of the A9 amendment. I think we've had it distributed. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Laurie, you want to take up the A8 amendment?
Yeah, there's also an A8 amendment. This actually is, some members were concerned that if state agencies build information systems to make sure that it goes through the Office of Enterprise Technology. This is actually already in state statute, so this is really kind of clarifying existing statute. There's no new costs to making sure that any investment over $50,000 go through OET to make sure that we're making best use of our information technology as well. So this is really just double checking, making sure that the existing statutes that would already govern this are clarified and reiterated in this bill as well. So that's the A8 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A8 amendment.
Okay, Senator Stumpf moves adoption of the A8 amendment. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further discussion or amendments on the bill?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a quick question, Senator Laurie. Is the coordination between electronic records include the veterans and I would assume between states that they would be comparable, where you have, let's say, around the edges of individual states, you'll have overlap on healthcare providers. How does the plan or the model address it?
I'm going to let Jim Golden from the Minnesota Department of Health answer that.
Okay, Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden, the Director of Health Policy at the Department of Health. Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, I think there are a couple of ways in which that is being addressed. First, the standards for exchanging health information are being developed at the national level so that all federal agencies as well as all states, whether it's public sector or private sector hospitals or clinics, are using the same information to exchange information. So that will help facilitate it across state lines. Second, at the federal level, all of the federal agencies are collaborating on activities to think about how do they exchange medical records for various individuals that they serve. One of the leaders in that area has been the Veterans Administration, and they are working quite closely with the Department of Defense as they think about some of our returning veterans as well. So that also will help to ensure that they are connected into the system. And then finally, the funding that the state of Minnesota has received that Senator Laurie had mentioned also requires a couple of things. It requires us as a state to work with the federal agencies with a very high focus on the Veterans Administration as well as Indian Health Services. It also requires us to use the national standards to figure out how we're going to connect to other states, particularly those states where we have the most traffic. So that would probably be the Dakotas, Wisconsin, and then perhaps some of the snowbird states.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, further questions? I know there's been a request for testimony from somebody who's here, so are there other questions for Senator Lori. If we could just give the gentleman a chance to testify for a minute. I think there was somebody here.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sure, if you can just come forward.
I didn't want to show everybody there's a proud supporter of the University of Minnesota. So. Hi, my name is Mark Hughes. Thank you, members of the committee and Mr. Chair, for this opportunity. I've been had Barrett's esophagus for about a decade, and it's been treated through an internist, Dr. Bill Armstrong, in Minnesota Gastroenterology. And when the insurances changed and I had a $2,500 deductible, I was given after we did the biopsy surgeries, of probably a $300 a month pill, and I won't bore you with all the names, but a $300 a month pill that worked pretty well. And then the insurance company saw the cost, and they decided I should go on a generic. Well, last summer I began having some troubles with this generic drug. Obviously, my body rejected it. And so I went to see the surgeon in Minnesota Gastroenterology, and she said we should contact your internist. So bear in mind that I had a $300 pill a month that was expensive, but I, in the last December, went through two biopsy surgeries, you know, 1 week and then the next week for an upper and a lower GI, and that cost was about $3,000. So my point is, for a $300 pill that worked for my body, I now have about $3,500 that I owe in medical bills because I've been on a generic drug, and obviously my body rejected it. And I just, it's the reality of life, and I wanted to testify and say that.
Mr. Chair?
Sir Roebling.
I'm just wondering if our testifier might want to testify on number 7 on the agenda, which has to do with substitution of of drugs.
That's what I was wondering.
Is it?
Testifying on the bill.
That's okay.
Bill, did I do it wrong?
That's okay. No, you did fine, but this is, my bill doesn't cover this topic.
Okay.
Yeah, we weren't quite sure, but can you?
I'm sorry.
I'll come back if you want. Or
sure, if you can. We're going to hopefully get to all the bills this afternoon, I hope. So if you can just stick around, that'd be great.
Ken, thanks much for
all right.
Sorry if I made any mistakes.
Nope.
No, it's
fine.
It's fine. You're fine. It's good.
So let's get back to Senator Lori. Other questions or amendments, discussion for Senator Lori's bill, Senate File 2974.
I'll move the bill.
Okay, Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2974, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Thanks, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda, we had Senator Dibble, who I think I saw here. Senator Metzen moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 2919. This comes from the Transportation Finance Subdivision on its way to the Tax Committee. Mr. Chair and members, what this bill seeks to accomplish is establishing transit improvement districts as a type of TIF district. Consistent with housing and redevelopment districts. And it establishes how to define a transit improvement district, and you can see that in Section 2 of the bill, the boundaries and adjacency to a transit line, and then the purposes for which those increments can be spent. In addition to the purposes permitted for redevelopment and housing districts, there are 8 purposes for which a transit improvement district increment can be spent, including improvements to the station area, the green space, the kind of public infrastructure that we're looking to develop in transit-oriented development around transit stations to shape and guide the kind of housing and services and amenities in the form and type of development and redevelopment that would best support transit service and likewise is best supported by transit service. Additionally, Mr. Chair and members, as we're looking at how other municipalities around the country have established interurban streetcar type of service that's, you know, short of light rail service, which is, of course, a regional type of transportation, but more neighborhood-to-neighborhood streetcar services, they've used some of the increment from their adjacent development to support the capital and operating of streetcars. So these increments can be used for that purpose as well. I have Jim Urkel here from the Center for Environmental Advocacy, who's not necessarily going to provide his own testimony, but is available to respond to questions or to further illuminate us about why this is such a great idea, if you so desire.
Yeah.
With that, I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
I was wondering, as I listened, Senator Dibble, and looked at this, wasn't quite sure why this was here, because this is basically a TIF bill. Right. But apparently there was...
the Transportation Committee had wanted to hear it, and so needs to come up through your committee and to its way to taxes.
And to make sure that there's no additional cost to the Met Council or any place else, but it appears not to be the case. Questions for Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, would this take development that otherwise would be available to the city or county at large away from them for something else in relationship to transit?
No, Mr. Chair and members, this is the available. If a transit improvement district were established around a transit-oriented development, if a district were established and then a TIF district were established as a subset of that, the expenditures would also be consistent with those for redevelopment districts or housing districts, or some of these other purposes. So it's intended to be additive. It's not intended to take away the purpose of those increments.
Mr. Chairman, and well, maybe I didn't make my question clear enough. Would it be taking away tax base from the city in which this district would occur?
Well, the answer to that question is, some people have a dim view of TIF. You know, it's the same as any other sort of TIF district. So, you know, there's of course the but for test. Would that tax base even be there but for the development that would occur because of the availability of TIF and because of the investment that we make in transit in that location? So by one perspective, no, because the development wouldn't even occur. By another perspective, of course, it takes some of the increment of those new taxes. Now, there's nothing that says that you have to use the entire increment, of course.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, let me ask the question a little bit differently. What is there in the current tax increment financing law that requires us to create transit improvement tax increment financing districts? Is some of this money somehow going to be used to actually finance the transit project?
Mr. Chair and members, it's not available for the kind of transit improvements or transit services that we currently pay for LRT or bus rapid transit or commuter rail or any of those. It's not available for those purposes, if that's your question. It might be available, and the city, of course, would make that decision in conjunction with the county for streetcar service, if they decide that that's a good idea to serve the mobility purposes up and down a particular corridor. But it's not another way to pay for LRT or bus rapid transit or even regular route bus service. That would still fall under the existing regimen that we have now.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, the existing tax increment finance law doesn't allow what you're describing to happen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, no, it doesn't. You know, for the purpose, specifically focusing attention on those sorts of public realm amenities that incent and encourage and support and help shape transit-oriented development, I think this is a tool that we don't now have available that any number of other municipal areas around the country do have.
Chair Mitzen.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to this, Mr. Chairman, but what if the district is already a TIF district and they're using the money for infrastructure and other things that was developed for, and then you piggyback on here, but there's no more money. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, yeah, and I think that would present a problem, a lost opportunity, unless we were, you know, there is some discussion about creating some pooling provisions so that there might be some available increment from other nearby districts that could be brought into districts like this for those purposes. That's not in this bill now. Yeah,
sometimes
there's some discussion about doing that.
Chairman, sometimes the existing districts are the one that would need this kind of transportation need, so I don't know where you'd get the increment. But
yeah, in that case, I think it's spoken for already, if they've used up the full increment.
Sir Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, can you use some of this money to put up a sign by the Twin Stadium that says if you turn right by the light rail, you're never going to get, you'll end up in the suburbs? Like I did yesterday.
Will that get your vote?
Will I get your vote then?
The answer, yes, it depends on
absolutely.
Your answer.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman.
Final exit.
Senator Stumpf.
Senator Dibble, on page 5, and you mentioned that the money cannot be used for paying the capital or operating costs, I believe.
For more regional transit, it can pay for streetcars, more localized transit service. Streetcars are, you know, they're you know, confined to a specific neighborhood. They typically, in most cities that have revived their streetcars, they're operated and paid for not by the state government or the regional government, but perhaps through a joint powers of local governments or by a specific local entity. So streetcars are, you know, they stop typically every block or every other block, unlike LRT, which stops only every mile. It's a more regional type service, or bus rapid transit, which is more regional type service.
That was just looking at that, and then on page 6, if you look at the disqualifier on clause B, talks about the authority must not expend tax increment from a transit improvement district for the direct cost of construction or operation. So you'd have to say that this, you'd have to, I don't know, is streetcar a defined term? It seems to me that streetcar would be a transit.
A streetcar is a form of transit, but it's local neighborhood service. It's typically owned and operated by the city, not the Metropolitan Council, not any state entity or agency. Yeah, well, we do have a definition here. It says a streetcar line on page 2, Senator Stumpf.
Okay.
Line 2.16 starting. It kind of gives us a definition of streetcar line. It's a circulator service that's located entirely within a single city, for example. It's not regional in scale. It's a, you know, inter-city or intra-city, whichever is correct, kind of neighborhood scale circulator service. And what paragraph B does is it excludes specifically and explicitly things like LRT, regular route bus service,
Mr. Chair,
bus rapid transit.
Mr. Chair,
Sarah Olson.
Chair and Senator Dibble, I'm amazed that you have excluded personal rapid transit, which is that same bill. But it's been very definitive that that's not included.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, will that
you just take the rails out, and you could.
We'll have more discussion, Senator Olson.
Okay, do we have further discussion for Senator Dibble? Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, before properties go into a transit improvement district, what are there public hearings, or what happens so that the property owners know what's going on?
Well, it's kind of the standard way that cities establish TIF districts. You know, they go through a process of establishing the boundaries and having hearings and gaining the consent of the other affected taxing jurisdictions.
Mr.
So it's, you know, any time a housing TIF district or redevelopment district or soils district, you know, some of those, all those various types of TIF districts are established. It's pretty well. So this doesn't set anything unique in terms of the establishment of a TIF district.
Mr. Chair?
Sir Roland.
So they still have to go and also get permission from, like, the school districts, which normally are not participants in this, mm-hmm. counties sometimes.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So, and they do have to give permission. They do sign off on it. I don't remember exactly how the process works.
Anyone can help me, refresh me, or council can help. But I do recall there's some process for advice and consent from the other jurisdictions to establish a TIF, because of course their tax base is affected. You know, the schools, we offset that sum with state support, but you know, counties, of course, forego those additional revenues. So it's important to have the communication with the counties.
So, Mr. Chair?
Sarah Roland.
So if we offset some of the loss for the school districts, is that why you're here? Because there is a state cost to this?
Yeah, it's not reflected on the, but, you know, it's the same as any, it kind of all goes into the wash, and there's a, it's not reflected in the fiscal note or the revenue note. But, you know, there's always some implication of some amount for the state when it comes to establishing TIF districts, absolutely.
Okay, further questions for Senator Dibble?
Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, can you help me just a little bit? I'm thinking in terms of regional centers, or other cities, but I mean, many of those don't have light rail or commuter rail or bus rapid transit or streetcars. We have buses. Were buses just decided that in a bus form of transit would that would not be an appropriate use of or a method by which you'd qualify for a transit improvement district? I'm thinking about, would this apply to, or could it apply to my community or Duluth or Thief River Falls or Moorhead or cities that might have bus service?
Well, certainly, we envision passenger rail and transit stations and potential development and redevelopment around passenger rail. So when we get that great line to Rochester, that'll be an opportunity. Also, you know, bus rapid transit is one of those. You know, a lot of folks come to a particular place to access bus rapid transit to continue their journey. There's another opportunity. Typically, though, a regular fixed route bus transit that kind of serves, you know, broadly distributed network doesn't create the kind of redevelopment opportunities that more fixed route transit does. I mean, that's the essential difference between, you know, a transit way corridor and a more broadly distributed network of, you know, regular route bus service, bus rapid bus service, you know, just general bus service. It just doesn't create the kind of kind of more mixed use, somewhat denser development around transit stations, as does LRT or BRT or commuter rail or intercity passenger rail. So this wouldn't really be the tool to apply in that instance. This envisions transit-oriented development, quarter mile, half mile around a particular spot where lots of folks are coming to access that form of transit, or who want to come to that spot to get to their, you know, their job is going to be proximate. Services and other amenities that they're going to access are going to be there, and there'll be more housing located close to that particular station where a lot of folks can pick up their line.
Chair, Senator Dibble, I mean, some of our communities, because of just the lack of parking in the downtown core, really do have a lot of parking, you know, park and ride kind of situations, and, you know, using bus service. Maybe we can talk about it later some other time.
I'd be happy to talk. If we're talking about a spot where a lot of folks are coming to access transit, the development, you know, the kind of economic, potential economic activity that that generates, because a lot of folks are coming to a spot where they're going to, you know, get on a bus, and so their services, amenities, you know, they might want to live near there so we can develop housing there, develop jobs and job opportunities proximate. That's what this tool is designed for.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, it was just a matter of, you know, if we just called our buses streetcars, then we'd qualify, but and I still don't for sure know the difference between a bus and a streetcar.
The difference is, you know, you've got a fixed guideway, you know, you've got infrastructure that's in place. It's not just rubber wheels on a road that, you know, could just as easily through the flip of a switch or, you know, a pencil on a map be sent off on a different route. It represents that long-term investment in a specific location that gives developers the confidence that folks are going to be coming to that spot for quite a while so they can make that investment for denser housing that's mixed in with other sorts of services, amenities, jobs, education institutions, you name it.
Okay, further questions? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your description, you indicated some different things than what I would be useful, and I think there are folks might do it, but the difference in Duluth, for instance, who had a bus service, that the bus service was a rubber tire service. It wasn't the steel wheel that, or the rubber tire in some places that Duluth and there's several other places in the state in the early 40s that had these kinds of transportation that you're talking about.
Well, I mean, it does include bus rapid transit, Mr. Chair, Senator Foley. And bus rapid transit represents that kind of fixed investment that's specific to a certain corridor conceptualizes a station, an intermodal facility. Folks come, you know, where lots of folks are accessing that transit in that spot. So it doesn't exclude the idea of buses, but, you know, the idea of buses as a rapid transit, as an expressway type concept. Buses that just kind of meander around neighborhoods on a regular daily schedule, that are kind of a more broadly distributed network sort of service that we're very accustomed to in the Twin Cities, the kind of bus that I take regularly, just simply does not create the kind of development potential that more fixed transit type service does. So bus rapid transit absolutely does have some of that development, redevelopment potential, to be sure. And typically bus rapid transit has some element to it that, you know, some sort of dedicated right of way that, you know, that tells the developer and is reliable and is going to be here for a long time, you know, this particular route, and it's going to come to this station. Then you can get on your local bus at this station, or you can get to your job that's close to that station. So rubber on asphalt is not excluded, but it's a more express type service than your regular route neighborhood service.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, on page 5, lines 23 to 27, it talks about things that money may be expended from the tax increment, and it lists things like streetscape improvement, safety features, things that will provide convenience. And then it says, or enjoyment of users of the qualifying transit line and other pedestrians, including decorative lighting and surfaces, plantings, display and exhibit space, adornments, seating, and shelters. And I'm wondering, you know, who makes the decisions on what is for the enjoyment of users and what adornments are? Is final approval for these plans given by an elected body, or how will this all develop? I'm wanting to. You don't want these to be mm-hmm. ugly features, mm-hmm. but you don't want to go overboard on them either, so that we may be expending this tax increment in a way that a number of the public might not approve of. Mm-hmm. But we're giving them pretty broad permission here, mm-hmm. and not defining it very tightly. So how are we going to have control over it?
Well, as is true of you know, how we expend tax increment, you know, that's a decision of the local municipality. Feel free to jump in. He's writing me notes, and I just say, he you can speak yourself. the city council, who's accountable and who's elected by their own constituents, I think is who would develop the transit improvement district and the plan for the transit oriented development area and what the public realm amenities might look like. So, I mean, they're not going to bring the plans back here, I hope. I don't want to have that level of involvement. But, this is a tool that's been used to great effect to create the kind of transit-oriented developments that we've seen be so successful in other cities that have, frankly, not been so successful yet, even with the great success of the Hiawatha Line. But in terms of its development and redevelopment potential, we haven't really realized that yet here in the Twin Cities.
Okay, further questions or discussion on the tax bill in front of us?
I'll move the bill.
To the tax. Okay, Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 2919 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, I see Senator Kubley and Senator Bonoff in front of me. I don't know who was here. Senator Bonoff is, I guess, ahead of Senator Kubley on the calendar, so on the agenda. So Senate File 2505. Oh, and Senator Sharon's back there.
And she's ahead.
Well, Senator Sharon's actually first on the agenda. Sure. That's what she gets for sitting in the back, though. So Senator Sharon, Senate File 633. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. This is a bill that really moved through the Senate last year. It was a Senator Berglund bill. But we referred it back here to finance because the House introduced this bill again and changed some of the language in the bill. This is a bill, by the way, that has primary care providers engage in work that helps with prevention for child and teen dental caries as a part of the well-child visits in the primary care physicians' offices. And why this is back in front of you again from last year is that we have changed language that says that this must occur to that it should occur. And the belief is that as there are reports to indicate how much of this activity does occur, that we can revisit and strengthen that language later. So it's simply a language change and doesn't really have any fiscal impact.
Well, I think, Senator Sharon, that's actually does change the bill significantly. As I understand it, the bill is originally introduced and presented potentially would have had a fiscal impact. And by allowing the change to shall encourage, takes away the fiscal impact of the bill.
Yes, correct. It does. In terms of a fiscal impact, it is significant. In terms of what operationally it does in the primary care physician office, it achieves the same objective.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill for Senator Sharon.
Okay. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 633 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Then Senator Sharon, you next have Senate File 2998. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'd like my presenters to come forward. Thank you very much, Chair and members of the committee. This bill refers to a program of all-inclusive care for the elderly. It's called PACE, and it's a capitated benefit that's been authorized in 1997 by the Balanced Budget Act and features a comprehensive set of services for persons who are over the age of 55, elderly and frail. We already in 2005, this legislature did engage and pass legislation that would allow Minnesota to participate in the PACE program. But at that time, we did not provide any funding mechanism in order to do the administrative work or do any of the actuarial work that is necessary in order for us to set rates and to give information to providers who may want to step forward and become PACE providers. So PACE is a capitated benefit that was authorized in 97. We have done the work the state needs to do to make us authorized to be able to provide pace. What we're doing today is presenting a funding mechanism for you. So I have with me persons who are willing to talk to you about how this is a service reform program, how it's a payment reform program, and talk about how we are going to fund this in order to accomplish a couple of objectives to get it up and running, and then in the future see it as self-sustaining. So, Toby, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jennifer McNerney, and I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota.
And it's nice to have you back in the Senate.
Thank you, Senator. Good to see you.
We have former staffers showing up, but go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota, also representing the Long-Term Care Imperative. And Senator Sharon actually did a very nice job of summing up the bill, so I will just very briefly say Senate File 2998 is a culmination of five-year effort to implement PACE in Minnesota. PACE is a primary care-centered, home and community-based services delivery model that provides care for older adults. This federal program is often called a healthcare home for seniors because it is really an excellent example of the healthcare home model. PACE is currently operating in 31 states nationwide. The program creates an integrated delivery and payment system. Medicaid and Medicare payments are integrated to pay providers to deliver care in a person's home / in the community. Providers are paid to deliver services normally outside the healthcare field, such as transportation services to get somebody to a doctor or to a grocery store to enable them to remain more independent. This model has been proven in other states to keep seniors in their homes and independent longer and therefore delay more costly nursing home admissions. PACE is supported by providers of older adult services, including the Long-Term Care Imperative and the member organizations of the Minnesota Leadership Council on Aging, which is a coalition of 16 nonprofit organizations that serve older adults. And in your packets, you do have a letter of support from both the Imperative and the Leadership Council on Aging.
Thank you. And also with me is Larry Johnson from the care providers, who will talk about how we are going to support the actuarial work.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Larry Johnson. I'm here representing care providers of Minnesota as well as the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'll be addressing the funding mechanism proposed in Senate File 2998, specifically the A2 amendment. The language in this amendment uses the CSSD grant pool. It proposes $154,000 in fiscal year 11 and $139,000 in fiscal year 12 to fund this program. CSSD, as we've mentioned, is a grant program that's funded by the legislature. The legislature funds it at approximately $6 million each year and is directed to help communities rebalance their long-term care delivery systems. The grants help people 65 years of age and older stay in their own homes and communities, improve chronic disease management, expand long-term care capacity, and support caregivers to promote independence through market-based solutions. At the end of the last round of grants, there was money left over, and after this appropriation, there should be over $1 million remaining in the grant pool. The money is directed into the general fund and then appropriated by the Commissioner of Human Services to complete actuarial work necessary to begin PACE in this state. The PACE concept will be a self-sustaining program after the initial startup actuarial work is completed. The amendment also includes language about future funding for the ongoing administrative work in fiscal year 2013 and beyond. Department staff and several key stakeholder groups will be able to report to the legislature by January 15th of 2011 about the future sources of funding for this ongoing expense. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and members, for your time. We'll be happy to answer questions at this point. We also do have staff from the Department of Human Services to answer technical questions about the funding source, if there are any.
Okay. And Mr. Johnson, with using the development grants, I take it this is not taken away from something else. This fits into what the department intended?
Right. The way the grants are proposed, there's a grant pool, and this takes money that's already been allocated to that grant pool. It doesn't take grant money from existing grantees.
Have we done this before where we've specified in statute a particular allocation from the grant for a grant?
We're seeing nods from the department that we have done this in the past.
Okay. All right. Questions for either witness? Sure. Sarah Stumpf.
In the letter from the Minnesota Leadership Council, it says here that PACE is to be self-sustaining. It's supposed to be a self-sustaining program after the initial startup. How does it become a self-sustaining program?
If you read further in the bill, it says that the commissioner must work with stakeholders to develop financing mechanisms to complete the actual administrative costs. The commissioner should inform the legislature on development financing mechanisms. This Friday, as a matter of fact, the group is meeting to talk about that very question, about sustainability. The difficulty we have in answering that question very clearly right now, Senator Stumpf, is it's hard to know. One of the proposal really is to have a fee assessed, a licensing type of fee assessed to those who are PACE providers. But without the actuarials and without knowing what the rates are, it'll be difficult for us to know what that is and what the implications are. But that's the general overall concept. And so we're going to be working to refine that after we have more information to determine what that will be.
Thank you.
And I understand that there's an amendment to, we have the division report in front of us, which has the appropriation, but I'm told there's an amendment that changes the appropriation. Is that correct?
A2.
Yes, Mr. Johnson. The A2 amendment, I understood that Senate Council had that amendment.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, is there an income base to the eligibility of people participating in this program?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there actually is not an income base. Anyone who is eligible for a certain level of care would be eligible. However, about, I think, 95% of people enrolled in PACE are eligible for Medicaid.
Okay, before we get to amendments, are there other questions for the witnesses or for Senator Sharon? Okay, Senator Sharon, am I correct relative to the amendment? I think it's proposed by
It's proposed
council.
By Senate Council, and yeah. We're supportive of the
Okay, it's been distributed. Who would like to explain it, Mr. Mossman or Mr. Watson? What?
Well,
did you do it?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members, Mr. Chair, I think what you're referring to is we just noticed that under subdivision one, the language there, the intent of the language there under subdivision one of the A2 amendment is to reduce some appropriations made in 2009 session law in this budget so that those appropriations can be available for this program under subdivision two of the amendment you have before you. But there needs to be some clarifying language in subdivision one to make it so that the appropriations are actually reduced in the budget bill you adopted last year. And one more point in the way of background is the budget bill that was adopted last year for Health and Human Services, Chapter 79, was later amended by Chapter 173. And so I tell you all of that in the way of background, and that the oral amendment here is going to sound more complicated than it is because it has to reference both of the idea here is to just reference back to those laws. And so if you would, members, on line 1.5 of the amendment, after the period, if you were to insert the appropriation for community service development grants made under laws 2009, Chapter 79, Article 13, Section 3, Subdivision 8, Paragraph A, as amended by laws 2009, Chapter 173, Article 2, Section 1, Subdivision 8, Paragraph A, and then you would delete everything. You would go on then to pick up the language on line 1.6 of the amendment to say, is reduced by $154,000 in fiscal year 2011. And then on 1.7, you would insert the language, the base is reduced by $139,000 in fiscal year 2012, and insert after that, and by zero in fiscal 2013.
I didn't get it all.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a little much for an oral amendment, isn't it?
I think we usually
try to limit the size of those.
Unless Mr. Mawson can do it from memory, I think maybe we should.
Mr. Chairman, it was very clear. He stated it succinctly and clear.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure Senator Fishbach got it.
Senator Olson should repeat it.
Mr. Chair, I think even Senator Betzold gave up trying to write it down, and he's usually really good about that.
Yeah, about halfway through, I stopped.
Well, I'm wondering.
If he can just write it out.
His handwritten.
Yeah.
I trust him.
Yeah, let's. This is, even though it's simply a statutory reference, let's have it prepared in writing so we know what we're actually voting on. On the bill itself, are there other questions for Senator Sharon? And maybe Mr. Johnson, I'll ask. I'm a little bit confused in talking to Mr. Watson. Is the language, putting aside what the statutory reference change that Mr. Mawson suggested, is the A2 amendment suggested by the department, or?
It was brought to us by the department as the funding mechanism, and we have someone specifically, as far as a technical question for.
Well, not so much a technical question, but what's the origin of the division report had the appropriation section one way. This is a significant change in the appropriation section. So I'm wondering what leads to it or why we're doing it this way as opposed to what came out of the division.
Mr. Chairman, we have Carrie Erber from the department to address that.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Carrie Erber. I'm with the Department of Human Services. The main reason for the change in the language from the original, the fiscal note originally showed that there was actually revenue, but it was generated based on FFP. I can kind of why don't I walk through the riders just to kind of show you what we're doing? And we did this language to get the fiscal note to a zero fiscal note. The first rider is with the CSSD reduction. And the $154,000 and the $139,000 in fiscal year 12 is the state share that is being that grant amount is being reduced to offset appropriations that are going for the admin increase for the PACE program. The total cost of the program in fiscal 11 is $256,000. And it's split between healthcare administration and continuing care administration for the admin costs. And so the $256,000, that's for the administrative costs, and the $154,000 that's being reduced out of the CSSD grants brings the net difference to $102,000. Because the money is coming out of an admin account, we earn a 40% FFP off the $256,000. And the $239,000 in both years, and that FFP goes to the bottom line. So the total FFP that is earned off the $256,000 is $102,000.
Mr. Chairman, so what is FFP?
Federal Financial Participation. It's the federal share that comes in from the feds. So anyway, this was a means of trying to get the fiscal note to zero. When we had the other language, there was an offset of the $102,000, and staff at DHS felt that this was the easiest way of dealing with the additional FFP. The intent originally when we met in Senator Berglund's committee was that additional FFP would be returned to the community services development grants, and this way we're just reducing the amount taken from the CSSD grants.
Okay, I'm a little bit confused. In subdivision one, you have a one-time reduction for $294,000 or $284,000 or something like that, or $83,000. Mr. Moss points out that that's in fiscal 11. Then in fiscal 12, you have the reduction. Then you have subdivision 2, and that's a one-time reduction. Then you have $145,000 from the general fund, with base level funding at $130,000 for 2012. So I'm trying to match your testimony to the numbers we see on this.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll back up a little bit. The original language, we had $256,000 being taken out of the CSSD grants.
Yeah, and that's what's in the division report.
Yeah. And because of that reduction into the admin account, there was additional FFP that was shown as savings, and we were trying to get around that. And so what we did was we reduced the amount of the CSSD grant reductions by the state share, so it's $154,000 in 2011 and $139,000 in 2012. And then the subdivision 2 and 3 are the appropriation amounts that would go to health care administration and continuing care administration. And if you total those two subdivision amounts, that's the $256,000 in fiscal 11. And because that money is in an admin account, we earn 40% FFP on that, and that money drops to the bottom line as a non-dedicated receipt. So we are trying to take advantage of the FFP and to make it a zero fiscal.
Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'd request that this bill go back to division. We had a signed-off fiscal note on the original bill. And if we're getting a changed fiscal note now, I think it needs to go back to division.
Okay. Mr. Mossman, did you want to? That's, all right. Senator Sharon, this is getting a little bit confusing. So I don't know what Senator Berglund's schedule is like, but, the Finance Committee doesn't have a deadline, so we can certainly hear the bill well before the end of the session, depending on Senator Berglund's division schedule, but it sounds like we're getting a little bit afield from the division report, and so I'd share that concern. So if I could ask you, Senator Sharon, to...
Mr. Chair, members, I did give a tracking detail to Mr. Mossman showing that it is a zero fiscal note, but if you need a new fiscal note, we'd be happy to do one.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Sir Berglund.
My point is we had a signed-off fiscal note on the original bill. If you're going to change the bill now and give us a different signed-off fiscal note, it needs to go back to the division to be heard over again.
Well, and like I said, I don't serve on Senator Berglund's division, so I don't presume to have the in-depth knowledge she has, but this is getting a little bit confusing to, I think, a lot of people here. So I would suggest, Senator Sharon, if you could work with Senator Berglund, and if she had not been apprised of the changes, because obviously there does sound like there's a significant difference between the division report and the proposed A2 amendment. So why don't we strike this bill from the agenda? We certainly have a sense of what you're trying to accomplish, and I don't know if there's objection to that at all, but make sure that the division understands what's going on with appropriations within the division's jurisdiction.
That'd be great.
Okay,
thanks. Thank you very much.
All right, so, Senator Berglund, we'll send it back to you and have you take over on it. So next we have Senate File 2505, Senator Bonoff, and she now is approaching the table very carefully and gingerly because she's not sure what's going to happen to her. So,
Mr. Chair, members, Chair? I don't feel that way at all, Mr. Chair.
I'd move the division report.
Senator Betzel, you took the words out of my mouth.
I said that.
He was waving stuff at me. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill reflects the vision of the Early Childhood Caucus's desire to create a statewide quality rating and improvement system across early child care and education programs. This initiative would expand our vision by helping providers and programs build quality. This legislation builds on the $1.3 million in ERA funds that we directed last session toward training, coaching, consultation, and supports for the QRIS. The ERA funding starts out going to providers this summer through the resource and referral networks, and our bill would move more of the federal CCDF funds toward quality. It is anticipated that 200 providers will be served by this current appropriation. An additional $500,000 should serve more than double that amount. So this $500,000 represents 5.5% of the total $10.3 million that Minnesota receives in federal child care development funds. The other funding is used to support the Child Care Resource and Referral System, the Child Care Services Grant Program, as well as for professional development. So this is not new money, nor new state money. This CCDF funding alignment with the QRIS has been a recommendation of national consultants that we have been working with, and it's consistent with what DHS has been doing on its own. Providers received this funding before through grants and supports. This only aligns the standards and requirements of the grants with the QRIS. So examples of grants are obtaining free or low-cost training on curriculum and assessment and consultation on the environment rating scale. And members, I can tell you that we've been going around the state meeting with child care providers, letting them know about the QRIS. And one of the things that we've heard consistently that they have the greatest concern is how they're going to be able to get support and training. So with this legislation, I think that does send a signal to that group that we are very serious about making sure they do get the kind of support that they need in order to be part of the voluntary QRIS system. I stand for questions.
Okay, questions for...
Move the bill.
All right, Senator Berglund moves that if there are no questions, Senate File 2505 be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair, no further.
Senator Roebling.
I just have one question, Senator Bonner. I expect that there might be a lot of applicants for help through this program. So who will determine who gets the funding?
Senator Roebling, Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I believe this will be through the child care resource and referral, so they will make that decision. We do have Nancy Johnson here, able to answer specific questions if you want to talk about the process. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff, and... Senator Roebling, the process is.
If you could just identify
placed.
Yourself.
Oh, I'm
please.
Sorry. Nancy Johnson, and I'm an early childhood consultant. And the process in Minnesota has been in place for many years through the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral. They use local advisory councils in all of their areas, and those councils or those committees put out information that then providers fill out their proposals and submit those, and then that's how it's done. So it's a fairly localized process.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
With 60% of our providers being in-home providers, are those resources allocated proportionately then so that the home providers are getting equal opportunities to this money like the other providers are?
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, I can't tell you that it is being exactly allocated in that way. I can tell you that that's who we've been reaching out to as we've gone around the state. We've specifically gone to the in-home licensed provider community and brought them to the table. I actually went and had a brunch just a couple weeks ago with 12 different member groups in my community to let them know about this, and that is a reflection of the commitment that we do make this available to them. So while I can't tell you that it's exactly the correct percentage, we are making sure to include them in this process.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Berglund has moved that Senate File 2505.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Just real quick, this Senator Bonoff, this is a statewide bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, this is a statewide bill. We aren't yet statewide with our pilots. We're only in the same pilots we were before, but we're trying to build quality statewide so that when we can expand, we're ready.
Well, Senator Bonoff, I'm going to visit with you because I have a child care center in my town that's going under. I'm trying everything I can to try to get some money. And it fits into this because they take them from little kids to...
Mr. Chair, Senator Vickerman, I'd love to meet with you and get more information.
Senator Berglund has moved that Senate File 2505 be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Next on the agenda, Senator Cooley. Senator Cooley, Senator Berglund's got a conflict. Could we just take her bill out of order with that, even though she's on the committee? Would that be okay? Okay. Thank you. So let's go to Senator Berglund. Senate File 2702. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members of the division, this is a bill that licenses birth centers, and the fiscal note shows some general fund savings in our health care programs, but we would be carrying any savings that there would be in our omnibus bill, but we wanted to have the birthing center licensure bill go separately. I do have an amendment that will be reducing the fiscal note savings, but for the purposes of this hearing, I think the best thing to do is to look at the Department of Health fiscal note, because that is the fiscal note that reflects the cost of licensing and the revenue coming into the special revenue account, and then the costs coming out of the special revenue account of licensing the centers. And you can see that those amounts of money are good. I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer. It's an A8 amendment. Department of Human Services let us know last week that they need to have the rates for the birthing centers in the bill. Otherwise, they would be giving us a fiscal note for rulemaking. And this would, they would have to do a new fiscal note on the savings, because we would be, in this language, giving the birthing centers 70% of the hospital rate for an uncomplicated vaginal birth. And they had figured the fiscal note on 50%. But we, as I said, we would be carrying those savings in our omnibus bill. So we know there's savings. The question is, how much savings?
Senator Berglund, I think I have a sense of what you're doing, but I had to ask this. Is this something, I mean, the amendment changes, I think changes the fiscal note.
Slightly.
So
the savings would be just slightly less.
So how do we distinguish this from Senator Sharon's bill?
Mr. Chairman, the main reason for doing this bill is to have the birthing center licensure pass. The federal reform bill says that Medicaid will pay for birthing centers, so it seems to me that the main idea here is to get a law that would license birthing centers. The fact that it gives us a fiscal savings is a small side benefit. But if we don't have licensed birthing centers in the state...
So what's important to you is the licensure part.
Right.
Of it.
Right.
Okay. All right. That helps.
I guess the fiscal note that you have is to the amendment, Mr. Chairman. Fiscal note you have is to the amendment. I unfortunately don't have that fiscal note, but I will get it shortly.
Okay, I've got a fiscal note that says completed date. I think Mr. Mossman has a preliminary fiscal note, which has not been distributed. Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair and members, and Senator Berglund, in the preliminary fiscal note, It's my understanding, I'm just looking at the amendment and wanting to make sure that we have everything that's needed in the amendment. It's my understanding in the revised fiscal note that there is likely to be a request for some one-time amounts for MMIS, and I'm for the department to implement the change, and I'm wondering if there needs to be an appropriation in the amendment or the bill to do that.
Usually what they do in our omnibus bill is they take everything we've got and they give us, rather than one by one, they give it to us for the total thing. And I think this would be better in that category as part of the total MMIS changes that are needed. So that appropriation would be made in the omnibus bill rather than in this bill.
Mr. Chair and members, and for the record, the department is nodding their heads affirmative to what Senator Berglund is saying and negative that there's an appropriation needed at this time.
Okay. So, Senator Berglund, are you offering then the A8
yes.
amendment as presented?
Yes.
Okay, has that been distributed?
Yes.
I think, okay. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A8 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? I'm sorry, Senator Betzel, did...
I had a question after the vote.
Okay. All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion's adopted. Senator Betzel.
Just to clarify, Mr. Mosman said he had a preliminary fiscal note in our packets. We've got a fiscal note dated March 22nd. Is that
right.
the correct
No, that's what we've been discussing is, okay. is that that's the small change that Senator Berglund's talked about.
Okay.
Mr. Mosman, do you want to just
Mr. Chair and members, in reference to Senator Berglund's comments, and again, we usually try not to use preliminaries just in case there's any changes and the department is here, so I will rely on them to jump up if there's concerns. But according to the preliminary, relative to the fiscal note you have that shows a small savings of $24,000 in fiscal 2011, the revised note, when it's completed, is indicating that there will be a savings to the general fund of $10,000 rather than $24,000. And then in fiscal 12, a savings of $138,000, and in fiscal 13, a savings of $253,000.
And as I said, we would be carrying that in our fiscal note, I mean, in our bill as savings, but I think the idea of having licensed birthing centers is an issue that needs to be heard and voted on its own on the floor of the Senate and not tied up in an omnibus bill because of a fiscal note savings in our health care programs.
Okay. Is there further discussion or questions for Senator Berglund? Okay, if not, Senator Berglund moves that... Senate file 2702 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in figure signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Senator Kubley, thanks for waiting. We have Senate file 3019. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have an amendment that was prepared by Mr. Giel that makes sense to me, and maybe you'd like to handle that first. It's the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Well, we've got the division report. Maybe you could just tell us what the bill is, and then we'll...
All right. There is a small error, and Mr. Hill from the department pointed that out to me, and it is correct on the bill, but on the bill summary, it says September 30th, 2010 in the last full paragraph, or 2015 in the last full paragraph, and it should be 2010, but it is correct in the bill. But the bill is basically allowing a local unit of government or a hospital district that owns a nursing facility to participate in a program that allows their facility to move to a rebasing rate if that governmental unit agrees to pay the non-federal share of the rate increase. And it does seem to me that that is something that would take place. Um, you know, it would make, you know, quite a difference for those nursing facilities, but those nursing facilities would have to ask their local governmental unit that carries the actual ownership of that facility to make the application for them to the federal level of government, and then they would be eligible for a rate increase. And I think there are 26 of those facilities listed in the back of the fiscal note, Mr. Chair and members. And you can see that there are quite a few Senate districts around the state that have a facility that would be impacted by that. And I think it would be quite helpful, certainly for those facilities that would fall under this particular plan, to help them with, you know, a negative cash flow over the past few years. It's too bad that it doesn't apply to every facility in the state, but you know, the ones that it does to would certainly be helped on that.
So, Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note shows general fund spending, but it would be federal funds that we would receive based on an increase in an appropriation by the local unit of government to the state to cover the increased state share of the nursing home expenditure. So it does not have a general fund impact.
And I think, Sarah Kubley, the division report and the amendment you're requesting is being distributed, but the division report indicates that this has to be done with federal approval so that there's no state action, or that the spending of the federal money is conditional upon the federal approval. Is that?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
We can't mandate local contributions, so there would need to be an approval process to make sure that these are viewed as voluntary contributions by the local units of government.
And if I can ask, are these monies, is this a bill being requested by the department?
No.
It's a bill that's being requested by several of the nursing facilities around the state, Mr. Chair. Okay.
And this is this accessing the federal stimulus money?
Mr. Chair and members, it's not federal stimulus monies that that would be used for this bill, but the amendment does pertain to receiving more federal stimulus dollars, and that's why the change in the delay in the date when it would become effective.
Mr. Chairman, the stimulus dollars had provisions attached to it about maintenance of effort. And one of the maintenance of efforts requirements were that you could not require additional funding by a local unit of government. So this amendment is appropriate to make sure we've gotten a federal approval that these contributions are voluntary and not mandatory.
And Senator Kubley, what's been distributed is the A1 amendment. Is that what you were looking for? Because that appears to be the same as the division report.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I didn't have access to the division report, so I assumed we needed the amendment, but that was prepared by Mr. Gill.
Okay. And well, unless somebody can tell me something different, it looks like it's the same thing. So
it was an amendment offered in the division, so
okay. It's
already been attached.
Okay. That's right. Fine then, Mr. Chair.
So we don't have an amendment in front of us. That being the case, okay, I was going to say, if there's no further discussion or questions for Senator Kubley, Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 3019 be recommended to pass. As amended, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Aye. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Higgins has Senate File 1137. Senator Berglund moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, this legislation directs the Board of Pharmacy to to adopt rules to protect epilepsy patients if the FDA determines that anti-epileptic drug substitution poses a risk to patients. This would apply to the current request made by Congress to have the FDA examine the issue as well as any later studies. If the FDA findings would necessitate modifications to the dispense as written statute to protect epilepsy patients, the legislation would allow the rule to supersede a provision of the statute. In division, an amendment was added that requires the board to report to the legislature before the implementation of the rule change if it is determined that the rule change would have a fiscal impact on the state. And then, Mr. Chair, I have an A4 amendment I'd like to offer, please.
Okay. If we could have the amendment distributed.
And Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment merely adds clarifying language to address concerns raised by the generic companies and the pharmacy benefit managers. And on a suggestion by Senate counsel, it also specifies which legislative members receive the report from the board in our usual way of saying the chairs and the ranking minority members of the committees with jurisdiction.
So Higgins, you're saying that when you said the generic companies were requesting this?
Yes, we've been negotiating with the generics and the pharmacy benefit managers all along, and I believe that this amendment would clear up their last questions on the bill. Okay.
So for those of us,
they're here to say something.
So when we say generics, who are we talking about? Individual companies?
I'm sorry,
or is there
the
an
companies
association?
Who make generics.
I mean, is there an association or is there a...
Is there an association? I don't know.
Ms. Cook, I'm just curious to know who these folks are.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook. I represent Mylan, which is a generic drug manufacturer. There's also an association, the Generic Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association. So we appreciate the opportunity to work with Senator Higgins and have this clarifying language.
Okay.
Happy to answer any other questions.
That's... All right, we have Senator Higgins has moved adoption of the A4 amendment. Is there further discussion on that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, this bill is supported by the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, the American Academy of Neurology, for whom I was an editor of one of their medical publications in the 1970s. Various neurologists who treat people with epilepsy, including physicians from the Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota, the Pharmacists Association, and the Board of Pharmacy are both supporting it as well. We have Benny Lauro here to testify or answer any questions for you. She is the executive director of the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota. And then I believe the gentleman who wanted to testify actually is this bill
Mr. Hughes. Okay, I don't know if anybody would like to have testimony from Ms. Is it? I forgot. I apologize. From the Association Foundation, but if not, Mr. Hughes, did you wish to testify on this bill? Yes. And Mr. Hughes, for the record, I'm just going to ask you to identify yourself again for our tape on this particular bill.
Okay, I'm Mark Hughes. I'm actually a member of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. And I want to thank the chairman and the committee for hearing what I have to say today. Some time ago, I was diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus and had to take one pill that's now worth about $300 on the open market a month. Within the last year, I became unemployed, and for one reason or another. But anyway, the insurance company then decided I needed a generic drug. We found out last summer that my body was rejecting the generic drugs. Thus, I went back and saw Minnesota Gastroenterology, who performed my biopsy procedures, and they in turn got a hold of my internist, who said, well, we better have a look at both the upper and a lower GI. So last December 16th and 23rd, respectively, I went not once but twice. And so my point is the economics of this whole thing for the generics, for the people whose body works can accept the generics, it's a great thing. It's a cost saver, and I understand that the state and the insurance companies are all looking to save money. I'm 50 years old, and I figured that out all by myself. But at any rate, for those people whose bodies it rejects through no fault of my own, I've now incurred about a $3,500 expense because I've had two procedures, had to have specialists come in to look and see what the problem was, wherein we could have got by with a $300 a month pill to the tune of $3,600 a year, and now I'm paying by the month. And I'm sure I'm not the only one in the state that has the problem, so it's not what was me. It's a thing of economics, and I'm just a little bit upset, number one, that I went through all this, but I'm tough and I made it. Number two, I've incurred this expense now, and I, by the way, support Senator Hagan's on her bill, but I've incurred this expense now, and I just kind of seem to be rowing the boat by myself. So I'm here to ask to see if you have any questions, if there's any help that I can get to help me along so this doesn't happen again.
Okay, I appreciate your comments, Mr. Hughes. One of the problems we have is, and the folks who hang out in this place understand that we have 10 divisions of the Finance Committee, and so somebody like myself who doesn't serve on the Health and Human Services division is hearing this for the first time. So I'm not, and not being an expert or very knowledgeable in terms of some of the statutes we have and rules of the department relative to the sale and distribution of prescription drugs, I'm not sure. So, Senator Higgins, I need a little bit of help from you. I understand what you're doing with the generic drugs. Is there any discussion of, and of course, your bill is dealing with primarily with epilepsy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you're not looking at other generic drugs for other kinds of disabilities, diseases, or whatever.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This is specifically for anti-epileptic drugs. And those of us who have been in the health, especially the health policy committees, but health finance too, over the years have heard from a lot of people who have been switched from the original prescription as written to a generic. And we have a state policy that encourages that. But even though the generics are supposed to be chemically exact replicas of the named drugs, they affect people in different ways. And so what Mr. Hughes is showing is one of those examples. And that's one of the things that happens with the anti-epileptics as well, is that even though a generic is supposed to be the same drug, in many people it isn't accepted, it doesn't work the same way. And whether it is the binders that are there in very minuscule amounts, whatever it is that is different, it is either well accepted or not accepted. Okay. This bill is specifically for anti-epileptic drugs at this point. But so those of us in the healthcare committees have heard this complaint from a lot of folks.
Mr. Hughes?
Members of the committee, if I could intervene, this isn't going to be settled today. But I'm just asking, is there somebody that I could come down and continue to talk to see if we can either put, with Senator Hagan's permission, an amendment to the bill or start writing a new bill? Because, the economics here, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. And I'm a taxpayer, and I'm not on medical assistance yet. I'm on COBRA, as a matter of fact, on Medica. but it's just not economically feasible. And I've went through some misery, and this isn't the first time, and I'm not alone. But I'm just saying, this should be looked into further. And if there's somebody I can come down and talk to, I'd really appreciate that.
And Mr. Hughes, appreciate those comments. My fear is, at least relative to Senator Higgins' bill, is things will move fairly quickly once from here the bill goes to the floor of the Senate, and we could hear it the next couple of days. Okay. And there might not be the opportunity to change her bill in any substantive way, but this is helpful. So there's a comment I wanted to make, but this is helpful then, Senator Higgins, so that I understand some of the distinctions, so that you're dealing with the particular disability, but not dealing with generics relative to other kinds of concerns. And Mr. Hughes is even a step further, where he's had to convert, because, as your testimony indicates, because of the Barrett's, from generic to the name drug. So I don't know if there's somebody here. I'm going to look for a volunteer, if not within the committee, but maybe somebody from the department, or maybe I could even volunteer Ms. Cook to maybe talk to Mr. Hughes, somebody who's more familiar with the industry, who could give you a little bit more of a history than I certainly can.
Yeah, and very humbly speaking, I'd appreciate any help I can get, because this has gone on now. And
I don't know if the new federal bill might ultimately play a role, but Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, and then I would also suggest that whoever represents Medica here might be able to help as well. That is the insurance company. The way I understand it, they're requiring him to use the generic, and maybe going back to the dispense as written provision is exactly what Mr. Hughes needs.
And I would accept.
Somebody needs to intervene there.
So if there's somebody, Senator Betzold?
Well, I think in fairness, we also have to let the witness know that we've passed a point in time in the session when policy committees can be looking at new issues. So it may very well be this, it might have to kick over to next year. So.
Well, anything,
yes, sir, I understand that, Mr. Wetzel, but had I known that this was going to happen earlier, I would have been here. It's that serious.
That's Mr. Hughes, that's, some of us have been here a long time, and we think there are places where it works quite well. This is a situation where, a citizen like yourself who just, maybe picks up something off the internet, or catches some chance, some article in the newspaper or something, you probably haven't hired a lobbyist, I bet, to represent you this afternoon.
Not yet.
So, but there might be, but there are certainly trade associations that deal with drugs, both generic and otherwise, and that's why I hate to volunteer Ms. Cook, but maybe she could, as somebody who's involved with the industry and would also be knowledgeable about what's taking place within the department, might be able to help you. Sure. I don't know if Mr. Lehman's volunteering or not, but Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Higgins, I just wanted to ask you a question. Does your provision, would that affect the private insurers as well as the medical assistance and the public programs, so that we could also tell the private insurers that sometimes they can't demand a generic, or are we only going to be able to tell the public insurers that sometimes that the generics aren't appropriate? Which one is yours addressing with the epilepsy in particular, or is it both?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, if I understood your question, this bill is not an outright ban of a substitution. It is asking for the department or the Board of Pharmacy to write rules on how it will take place if indeed the FDA makes a determination that the generic substitution harms people. So at that point, I believe it would be all-encompassing, but I think it's stay tuned is the answer. Okay. Anything
further
else?
Questions?
Mr. Chair, I move that 1175, let's try that again, Senate file 1137 as amended be recommended to pass. I think it just goes to the floor.
Yes.
Just a quick thank you to everybody.
No, and before we vote on the motion, Mr. Hughes, this just one other comment. This sounds like ninth grade civics, and I apologize. I don't know where you live, but I would certainly suggest you contact your senator and representative. The years, I've had a lot of calls from folks in my district about issues, some of which I know a lot about, some of which I know very little. And I've helped them. I've authored legislation on behalf of constituents where I might not have, a lot of substantive knowledge, but I learned the issue. So
I've been in contact with Senator Ortman, and that's how this all started. So, yeah.
Okay, well, that's...
Thank you much for that.
Okay, appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing this to our attention.
You're welcome. Thanks for your time.
On Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Thank you. Then last we have Senator Pappas, and Senator Pappas, I know this is a continuation of one of your many liquor bills over the years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have with me, in case there are any questions, Mr. Jake Murray, who is president of the Goal Line Club at the university. What we're doing with this legislation...
Senator Pappas,
Chairman?
Before you begin, just Senator Pappas moves adoption of the division report.
Oh, right.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last year there was a floor amendment that imposed a condition on liquor licenses issued to the University of Minnesota for any of their arenas or stadiums. And the condition required that if intoxicating liquor was served anywhere in the arena or stadium, it must be sold throughout the stadium or arena. The university or nothing could be sold or given away. The university decided that they didn't want to be the only stadium in the Big Ten to sell liquor to the general population, so they decided not to go ahead with that at all. And it cost them somewhere between $1 million and $1.3 million in profits. So I think that was maybe a little ill-advised, that floor amendment. And so my legislation repeals that and does allow them to sell liquor in premium seats or in the suites or give it away if any of the profit on the liquor sale must be used for athletic scholarships at the university. They not only lost the profits on the liquor sales, which is more like $200,000-$300,000, but they also had to discount their suites and their premium seats. And so there's a lot of competition for the suites and premium seats, and especially more so now with the Twins opening their new stadium, with the hockey arena. There's a lot of choices, and they all have the option of entertaining clients, for example, or your friends or whatever, by having alcohol. So it does really put the university at a competitive disadvantage, and they do. Like I said, it costs them $1 million, $1.3 million. So that's my proposal, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, just to be clear, as I'm looking at the division report, it doesn't quite specify where the liquor is to be sold. That would be a decision by the university. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, a decision by the university. If the university does decide, we do specify that the profits go into athletic scholarships.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, Senator Pappas, how do you define profits? How do you determine the profits as used in this new Section 1?
I don't know. Do you know? Sorry. Sure. Mr. Erickson, do you know?
Okay. Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, Jim Erickson for Friends of Gopher Sports. That is a discussion. It's a legitimate question. As Senator Pappas indicated, that it was pretty easy for the university to come up with $1 million to $1.3 million assumption from last year because they discounted the suites by 10%. We know what the liquor sales, we think we know what the liquor sales might have been. And by the way, the amendment took it away from Mariucci and Williams where it was. So they went back from at least two other venues to none. So they were pretty careful. Liz Yule, who you know, is the financial vice president for the athletic department. And they came up with that estimate. I think it's fair to say that and this year they're proposing to discount the seats and suites and boxes by 20%. So it's a little bit of an amorphous number, Senator, but I think we'd have to, and if you want to work on some language that was more definitive, but the idea is it's hard to know exactly what that was. When they turn around and are able to do this again, I think they'll have a pretty good idea.
I want to know how you define profit.
Yeah, well, I think we have the word net profit, don't we? As I recall, there was a profits. Okay. There was a discussion with council about net profits. Although profits are net profits, you know, I think the first word we had, Senator, was revenue, and then we wanted to go to net revenue, and I guess profit means net revenue. You ask a good question, and I'd be happy to work with Mr. Watson and anybody if you want to be more definitive prior to the floor, the time this came up on the floor. But that's as good an answer as I can give you right now, Senator.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Foley.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, it seems to me that we've elected the regents and given them the right and proper use of exercising those, and I think that we ought not to put any restriction on the university. That my thought on this was that it's appropriate. And that the if the regents want to have liquor sold in the stadium or athletic facilities, that they should be allowed to go forward with that. And I would be happy to have council draft legislation to do that if that, in fact, is the will of the group here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your support, Senator Foley. It's my understanding that the university does intend to use the profit from the liquor sales for athletic scholarships. You know, the money they make from the suites and the premium seats would go into some other kind of general fund or whatever for the university. But they do want, they're big on scholarships, so they would want to do that anyway. And we just thought that legislators might feel a little better knowing that some of the money is going into scholarships.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, I agree that that's an appropriate use, but again, I'd like to not have that tied down and to have the latitude to other things.
Just right, yeah, right. That's right.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Federer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I raised the question about profits, perhaps just to avoid controversy some point in the future. If you bought wholesale a bottle of wine for $20 and you end up selling it by the glass for $120, you know, somebody might say, well, the profit's $100, but we would know that it would take staff people to sell it, and it would take overhead for facilitating it. And I think just to avoid some concern in the future and some battle in the future, that be a little more specific about defining profits if we're going to keep this section in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, then there's two ways that we could go. We could leave the bill the way it is, and we could work on further defining what we mean by profits, or we could go with Senator Foley's approach, which is to just delete Section 1 altogether and leave it up to the University Board of Regents. So I'm open to either way.
Senator Pappas, it's your bill as to what you'd like to do or not do.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm not making a motion, so.
Yeah. Just the division.
But if someone else wanted to make a motion.
Well, are there any motions, any amendments, further discussion? Comments? Senator Pappas?
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 3180 be recommended to pass, re-referred to the Rules Committee.
Does it go to the Rules Committee?
Yes, I think we're coming from a policy committee.
Mr. Chairman,
no, we're not coming from
the reason you go to the Rules is that the House companion did not make its deadlines. So we've been working with this as a number, and any bill that is not,
it's not a late bill here, though.
We sent it to the floor.
Yeah, it's not a late bill here. It might be a late bill in the House. But
sorry.
Oh, fine.
All right.
I'll amend my motion.
Senator Pappas moves the Senate File 3180 as amended to be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. That concludes the agenda. Next meeting, 8:30 Wednesday, and then 8:30 Friday.